New research sheds new light on the origins of Native Americans. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about another oil spill into the Yellowstone River. And in our feature interview, reporter Everett O'Brien talks with a Montana Farmers Union official about the pros and cons of the new farm bill. DNA evidence recovered from ancient human remains found in Montana provides definitive answers to the origin of Native Americans. Scientists unveiled the new research published in the journal Nature today at the Montana Historical Society in Helena. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says remains of the so-called Anzac Boy show a direct lineage with most Native peoples in North, Central, and South America.
It's the story of a burial, putting to rest a two-year-old boy north of present-day Livingston. State archaeologist Stan Wilmoth says it was a Montana very different than what we see today.
An area that was not far removed from receding glaciers at the time.
About 12,600 years ago, the people at this burial,
we imagine that they probably were in small extended family groups following the mammoth herds.
The young boy they buried is now providing a lot of answers.
I was just a small child in 1968 when the only Clovis burial site ever identified was accidentally discovered on my parents' property in Wilsaw, Montana.
That's Stephanie Anzac. Today, she's a molecular biologist who has been studying the remains of the bones found on her parents' place for years. It's the oldest human burial discovered in the U.S. and the only specimen ever found of the Clovis people. The Clovis are named for an archaeological site in New Mexico and are defined by their use of distinctive, sharpened tools like scrapers and spearheads. This last fall, Dr. Anzac and an international team of scientists took this discovery to a much deeper level, and they just published their findings in a study. They were able to produce the boy's genome. Co-author Professor Eska Willerslev works with the Center for Geogenetics at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark.
The genome shows without any doubt that this child is closely related to all Native American groups in both North America and in South America than to any other group of human beings in the world.
The genome shows 80% of all Native Americans alive today are direct descendants of this boy's family.
That's just incredible. I mean, you can say a direct relative, not only a relative, but a direct relative, so to speak, to so many contemporary people. So I think that's extremely important.
The research also confirms theories that Native Americans are of Asian descent, likely crossing into North America through a land bridge that has long since disappeared. Montana State University Native American Studies professor Shane Doyle says to tribes in the state, what's just as important as the scientific discovery, if not more so, are the cultural discoveries made here. The Anzac boy was buried with about 120 of the sharpened stone tools for which the Clovis people are known. Some of these tools are hundreds of years older than the young child, indicating they were heirlooms given to the boy in death. Here's Doyle.
This was a two-year-old boy. He wasn't a chief. He wasn't a great hunter. He wasn't a great warrior. But the respect and love that was shown for him was really beyond measure.
That's why Montana tribes plan to make this a reburial story, too.
We will be putting scientific data back in the ground. We will be putting conclusions, our research, future research back in the ground. But this boy is not meant to be put on somebody's shelf and taken off when they feel like it. You know, that's not what his parents put him in the ground for.
Plans are to bury the bones as near as possible to their original location this spring or summer. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, state and Flathead County officials are again asking for help in solving the February 2013 disappearance of a 32-year-old Kalispell woman whose maroon Ford Expedition was found abandoned near Poplar with her children's pet guinea pigs inside. Agent Mark Hilliard with the Montana Department of Justice's Division of Criminal Investigation said today that the Valentine's Day 2013 apparent disappearance of Nicole Waller is being investigated as a homicide. She was last seen in Fairview. Hilliard urged anyone with information to call DCI at 406-444-7068 or the Flathead County Sheriff's Office at 406-758-5600. He said an observation that might not seem important could break the case.
A warrant was issued today for the arrest of a 27-year-old Butte man suspected of hitting and killing a pedestrian as the man crossed the street. The Montana Standard reports the warrant for Lucas Hundley says he faces a negligent vehicular homicide charge for the October 18th death of 77-year-old John Hellander. Prosecutors allege Hundley was under the influence of alcohol or drugs when Hellander was struck. Officials said it did not appear Hellander was in a crosswalk.
Montana travelers headed to Idaho need to find another route besides Highway 12. That highway has been closed on the Idaho side 13 miles from Lolo Pass because of the avalanche danger. Steve Felix is a maintenance engineer with the Montana Department of Transportation. He says Idaho officials warn the closure could last several days.
I did talk to the engineer from Lewiston today. He said with the forecast and the potential danger, they're bringing some avalanche experts in to assess. But potentially it could be closed for several days.
Once again, Highway 12 on the Idaho side of Lolo Pass is closed, starting 13 miles from the pass at mile marker 161. In addition, the Flathead Avalanche Center issued a backcountry avalanche warning for the mountains of northwest Montana. The Gallatin National Forest Avalanche Center has also issued a backcountry warning for the mountains around Cook City. For the complete backcountry avalanche warning, go to www.flatheadavalanche.org or call 406-257-8402.
The Roman Catholic Diocese of Helena's bankruptcy filing lists assets of just over $16 million and liabilities totaling $33.6 million. The diocese filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization on January 31st as part of a proposed $15 million settlement with hundreds of victims who said clergy members sexually abused them and the church covered it up. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports court documents filed Friday indicated the diocese had $7.4 million in real estate and $8.7 million in personal property. The assets include Legendary Lodge on Salmon Lake, valued at $3.5 million, along with $6.1 million in deposits and loans owed by various churches or schools within the diocese. The filing said churches, cemeteries, and other property worth $33 million is held by individual parishes. The diocese reports $28.9 million in unsecured debt and $4.7 million in secured claims.
State officials and a company spokesman say a small amount of oil has spilled into Montana's Yellowstone River from the ExxonMobil refinery in Billings. Refinery spokesman Dan Carter said today that the Texas-based company was investigating the source of the spill after its discovery yesterday afternoon. Carter says less than a gallon spilled. Absorbent boom was placed on the river to keep the product from going downstream. State officials say a sheen of the from the oil was seen along the Yellowstone where cooling water from the refinery flows into the river. Montana Department of Environmental Quality spokesman Chris Sager says the sheen initially was about a foot wide and stretched for roughly 100 yards. Officials say downstream water users were notified, but no problems were reported.
Missoula police continue to investigate the cause of an early morning explosion that blew out windows in an apartment above Bernice's Bakery on 3rd Street. The resulting fire was extinguished before emergency personnel arrived, and a 46-year-old male resident of the apartment was uninjured. Police are looking for another male who left prior to their arrival and who may have been injured in the explosion.
Law enforcement officers in Kalispell and Flathead County went above and beyond the call of duty to recover stolen military medals belonging to a Vietnam War veteran. Greg Smith reported a shadow box containing his late brother's military uniform and medals was stolen from his frame shop on January 9th. Court records say the suspected thief tried to pawn some of them and scattered others around town. Flathead County Sheriff's Deputy Colton O'Connell found James Smith's Purple Heart by searching a snowbank with a metal detector. The recovered medals were reconditioned and other items were replaced, including James Smith's dog tags. The Daily Interlake reports officers gathered yesterday to return the medals to a grateful Greg Smith. Police Chief Roger Nassett said it was an honor to recover the medals.
The Farm Bill is now the law of the land, garnering unanimous support from Montana Senators Baucus and Tester and Representative Daines. This evening, we thought we'd take a few moments to get local reaction to the measure that was years in the making. Chris Christians is lobbyist and project specialist for the Great Falls-based Montana Farmers Union. In tonight's feature interview, Christians tells Edward O'Brien the Agricultural Act of 2014 isn't perfect, but provides certainty to farmers and ranchers as they head into this next year of planning, planting, and applying for those all-important operating loans.
They may be raising garden products. We have a lot of those in western Montana, down in the Bitterroot, where some wonderful gardening takes place. Go to farmers markets. You know that you're getting healthy, fresh food, and these folks are making it. But when you get into eastern Montana, where you're raising primarily grain, let's say it's winter wheat, barley, you need lots of acres, and that's extremely difficult for a young beginning farmer or a veteran getting established. And both of those programs have been funded in the Farm Bill that has just passed Congress and been signed into law by the president.
And that bill eliminates $5 billion in subsidies to farmers for their crops, subsidies provided whether they grew them or not. That was replaced with an insurance program, more or less, right?
Yes, it was. The federal government picks up a great portion of that. I think down the road you may see that changing in the next 5 years or in the next farm bill. And what it does for a farmer rancher to benefit from that crop insurance, you must have a loss. Rather than in the old days with direct payments, someone could get up to $750,000 in a payment and not have spent a day on the farm, but perhaps was a part owner and maybe did some of the planning. That's no longer the case. Right now, if you are a farmer, the maximum is $125,000 per individual or $250,000 for a couple. But with the crop insurance, and there is a subsidy for that insurance picked up by the federal government, so it's a transfer of funds, you will have to have a loss in order to qualify. But also really important is risk management programs for disaster. As you know, at the end of 2012, disaster programs went away. So when we had the big fires and the drought in southeastern Montana, those farmers and ranchers had nothing to come back to get some help. In the blizzards of South Dakota, when people lost thousands of head of their livestock, there was no program available to help them. With the new farm bill that was just signed into law, it is retroactive, so some of these folks will be able to get some assistance to rebuild their herds of cattle, their flocks of sheep, and so forth. And there's also a piece in there for forage, so that when we have this dry year, there is help for purchasing hay. When hay went as high as $200 and some per ton a year ago, farmers just could not afford it, and for that reason, they sold their livestock. The numbers of livestock nationwide are down. Obviously, the price of beef is up, and part of the reason for that is that we ship our livestock out of the state of Montana for feeding and for processing. Once it's processed, it gets trucked back into the state, and so we need to have more niche markets, some small slaughterhouse-type program whereby we can raise our beef, feed it out, slaughter it, and not have to pay all those additional costs.
I know country of origin labeling is a very important issue to Montana Farmers Union. Mr. Christians, how come?
People want to know where their food comes from, and you know that it's quality. When I look at tilapia as an example, and the last time I went to the store, I looked at the label. It came from China. People would be shocked if they realized the fertilizer and the food and how it was fed to these fish came from. It comes from human feces. I don't want to be eating that stuff. Right now, if I went to a grocery store, unless it's a fresh food store, I would doubt that you're going to find a tomato in that store that was raised in the United States. What were the growing conditions where that tomato was raised? Do I want to buy it not knowing where it came from? The same thing is true of our beef. And so we have been front and foremost in that entire country of origin labeling issue for years and are tickled that it stayed in there.
And I don't mean to pit the farmers against the beef producers, but, you know, there are livestock groups who are not so happy about COOL. They think it's expensive and ineffectual.
They do, and in fact, the National Cattlemen's Association threatened to have members of Congress vote no on the entire farm bill, even though there was disaster payments for loss of livestock, and frankly, I'm rather offended. I raise cattle. The people that are buying my livestock were the very ones trying to kill the farm bill. That is not in the best interest of the producers of the state of Montana who are raising healthy livestock. Why shouldn't we be able to get a premium on the livestock that we're raising, and we know what they ate, we know where they were raised, we know that they're good, healthy for the consumer who in the end is going to be eating that beef, lamb or pork.
From the Montana Farmers Union's perspective, what sort of impact does the Farm Bill have on various conservation programs? Good, bad, and different ones?
Well, some of the money that was going to conservation has moved a bit. There is going to be land taken out of CRP, as an example, but it's been moved around, and frankly, the 2014 bill actually loses money when you talk about sequestration, because that's about a 7% automatic. So we're going to wait and see, but we hope that the conservation programs will continue to be good for us. We have land that has been in CRP that will be coming out, and I believe it's something like 2 million acres in the next year nationwide. Last year, about 188,000 acres came out of CRP in Montana. Some of that land probably should never have been broken to begin with. It should have stayed in CRP. However, you know, I think farmers and ranchers are good stewards of the land, and if it is marginal, they're not going to be planting crops in it. But conservation did get cut, and I believe they got cut by about 9.5%. The commodity subsidies were trimmed by almost 9% overall from the budget. But, you know, we can live with it because it gives our farmers some certainty, at least for the next few years. Of course, I'm saying I worked for 2.5 years on the last one that just went into law, and probably in about a year I'm going to start working on renewal of the next farm bill. So it doesn't happen overnight, but right now we're happy with the results of the current one.
The SNAP assistance program was a real sticking point. The Farm Bill cuts $8 billion from food stamps over the next 10 years.
That's about 1%, but the entire Farm Bill, 79% of it goes to food stamps and nutrition. And the costs for that program over the last few years have gone through the roof. Part of that was due to the recession. And I don't think that in Montana it was as severe as it was in other states. I know in Great Falls, our problems with recession were not nearly as great as they were in some of the urban areas. Mm-hmm. But about 23% of the farm bill, excluding nutrition, goes to commodities. 45% of that goes to crop insurance. Conservation is about 28%, and then everything else is about 4% of the whole bill. It does cut about $23 billion overall from the budget over the next 10 years, and while some people don't think that's enough, it certainly is a step in the right direction. And then the fact of sequestration coming in, automatically cutting about 7% per year from the various programs, it will amount to considerable savings to the nation.
Lastly, I guess the biggest challenges and disappointments that your organization is finding in this would be what?
Well, although I frankly don't know, and Montana does not have a large dairy industry anymore, that is an area that did not get into this farm bill in an adequate way. Leaves a lot of questions unanswered for dairy states of Wisconsin, of California, still hanging out there. We would like to have seen a national sod saver provision in the conservation end, that some of this land would not ever be broken up. That did not happen. But, you know, overall, I think we're fairly happy with what happened. We got more positive things than we had negative, and so we're certainly not complaining.
Last question, I'll cut you loose, and that is, it took four long years to pass this thing. Did it have to be that way?
No, it did not. I think the lack of bipartisan work, the lack of compromise, is what kept this thing way out. But one of the critical pieces, again, is the lack of understanding of rural America and what agriculture means. The fact of 16 million jobs being attributed fully to agriculture does not seem to resonate the way it should in our urban communities. And so it was critical, I think, to keep the SNAP program attached to the Farm Bill. It was also important to keep permanent law in place, which it does now in this current bill, so that should a Farm Bill not happen, it could go back to 1949 cost of parity for the operations, and a gallon of milk going under permanent law would cost $8 a gallon. That will keep people's feet to the fire, because their constituents are going to be on them to do something about getting a Farm Bill passed. I can't say anything but thank you for all of those yes votes to get something in place that helps Montana's number one industry, which is agriculture.
And Chris Christians of the Montana Farmers Union, thank you so much for your time, and thank you and all your colleagues in ag for doing everything you do for this country and the world, in fact.
Thank you so much, Ed.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there is a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for the West Glacier region and Lower Clark Fork region. There is a winter storm warning in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains. Tonight, rain and snow are likely, with lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow, snow and rain are likely, and a chance of light freezing rain with highs in the upper 30s. For central Montana, there's a blizzard warning in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for the northern Rocky Mountain front, and a high wind warning in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for all of central Montana. There's a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for elevations above 5,000 feet for the southern Rocky Mountain front. Tonight should be partly cloudy with a chance of snow and lows in the 20s with wind gusts up to 65 miles per hour. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of rain and snow through the day and highs 40 to 45 degrees with wind gusts up to 55 miles per hour in the afternoon. Southwest Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for the Madison and Gallatin counties. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and rain and lows 25 to 35 degrees with wind gusts up to 65 miles per hour. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of snow and rain with highs in the 40s and wind gusts up to 50 miles per hour. And now for the editorial comments of Patricia Rosenleaf.
In praise of public schools, what do these seminal Americans, Thomas Jefferson, John Dewey, Horace Mann, Frederick Douglass, John Adams, and Susan B. Anthony, have in common? They were all proponents of public education. John Adams mandated public education in a letter when he explained, "The whole people must take upon themselves the education of the whole people and be willing to bear the expense of it. The school should not be founded by a charity or individuals, but maintained at the public expense," end quote. These Americans had seen firsthand the generations of inequality created by separating society into the haves and the have-nots, and fervently believed that our country could do better through a system of public education. I and a majority of Americans believe in public ed, but a few believe that the problems attributed to public ed mandate the formation of private schools, which are rumored to provide the best education in the world. Montanans, come to your senses. Nowhere in Montana will you find a private school that's going to do a better job at educating your children than the public school down the block. The myth of private school superiority has been disproven at every turn, unless you're talking about the 100-year-old-plus private schools that are endowed to their teeth and exist in a few back east. In order to have that caliber of private school, one would be forking over upwards of $30,000 a year times 13, and then be looking down the barrel of another 4 years of even more tuition, and that's just for one child. There are people who can afford such tuitions. The middle-class American is not one. Instead, over the years, we have put what money we can afford toward building a first-class public school system. Political scientist Benjamin Barber says that, quote, public schools don't merely serve the public, but rather create the public. And what a success story that creation has been. Over the past century, our public schools have produced architects, doctors, lawyers, house builders, teachers, writers, chemists, scientists, soldiers, Nobel Prize winners, plumbers, FBI agents, contractors, admirals, and a plethora of state and federal workers, and a few bums, to be honest. True, some of their endeavors may have put these people in the arena of the rich, but by and large, most move within the middle class, the backbone of our nation, the people who do the work, pay the bills, and keep our economy going. They were not privately educated. They attended and graduated from public schools where they were taught what they needed to be taught in order to go on with an education or receive more training or start a business of their own. Educating most of a large population is, to say at the least, a tall order. It's the component in comparisons where the apples get mixed up with the oranges. The fact that's oft overlooked or just not mentioned because it skews the outcome terribly when you want to show that other countries' schools are superior. Regardless of your intent, you have to consider that the public schools are tasked with dealing with all students, not just the gifted, not just the ones with parents who wait slavishly at home to help Johnny with his next project, but all students, those with mental problems or special needs, those who have been beaten, abused, abandoned, raped, and ignored. Year after year, though, the public schools do what they can given the limitations of money and the fact that support for the schools comes from the only tax that people can vote on. Licensed by the state and required to keep up with their own educations, the public school teachers deal with 31 to 150 of these kids on a daily basis, slogging through the basics, trying to provide the enrichment, the time, the experience that every student needs and deserves. Let me tell you, they work hard, and the majority, I believe, have been and continue to be successful. Of course there are problems, but if, as Robert Niles, a Huffington Post contributor, suggests, quote, you're a business leader and want to distract people from the fact that more Americans are slipping out of the middle class, even as you and your colleagues are getting richer than ever, how convenient would it be to fund foundations and contribute to politicians who will blame poor test scores in the hardest hit communities on failing schools instead of the growing child poverty problem that's causing them, end quote. So my message to you is this. You don't have to pay thousands in tuition every year in order for your kids to get a good education. All that will happen with the flurry over privatization of education is that the rich will always be able to buy an education for their kids. The middle class will have to work for it. Therein lies the secret to why public education is as important as it is. Those who have to work for something always gain more out of it than those who are given that thing. If you have to earn it, you end up with something to be proud of. That's the benefit of a public school education. Always has been, always will be, unless we allow the proponents of privatization to take away our great equalizer, as Horace Mann called it, public education. It has leveled the playing field of this country for years, allowing every student the equal opportunity to learn from, grow with, and benefit from a quality education. So if you're looking for a get-rich-quick scheme to enable you to send your kids to private school, there aren't any. But here's an even better plan to put in the hopper. Invest in education in your community. Make your community the kind of place that affords everyone an opportunity to become educated, that values a good education, that wants its children to compete and to live the American promise. Support your schools, attend their functions, let people know that you believe in the tradition that we alone in America have put forth for a century or more. Every person deserves an equal chance. Now, cue the Star Spangled Banner and raise the flag. Oh, this is radio, no visuals here. This is Patricia Rosenleaf, a retired public school educator, who to this day gets goosebumps when I say I am a teacher.
Patricia Rosenleaf is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.